A beta test for Southeast Texas as rains pummel the region. Roads are closed, schools shift plans, and officials warn to stay put. The story of the storm and more on today's Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. COVID has hit retail real hard, but what about retail politics? The pandemic's impact on a political season like few others in recent memory. Also, Latino political power in Texas, under lockdown or primed to make major waves come Election Day. The U.S. Department of Transportation gives the green light to the Texas bullet train connecting Dallas to Houston in 90 minutes. All aboard? Not quite. We'll hear the latest and have a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway. And that happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 22nd day of September. Hope your Tuesday's been going well so far. Certainly hasn't been a great day for many residents of Southeast Texas, that's for sure. And the rain from a tropical storm named Beta continues to come down. Jeff Lindner, the meteorologist with the Harris County Flood District, tweeted this morning a message that echoed what Fort Bend's county judge has said. Anyone who doesn't have to be on the streets should not be. Significant flash flooding was reported all around the Bayou City and beyond. The phrase, roads are inundated, was frequently invoked, as were warnings like, if you're in a vehicle, get to high ground immediately and turn around, don't drown. Creeks and bayous were rising rapidly at last check. People reporting on social media say they've never seen certain waterways like Braes Bayou quite as full as they are right now. Intersections like Highway 288 at 610, if you know that one, were flooded out, and you could see flooded out vehicles in the water. Some school districts, including Klein ISD, Aldine ISD, and others, had moved all classes online. Several surface streets in downtown Houston were flooded too. Now, as we go to air on this Tuesday, we get the latest on the weather picture from Jeffrey Evans. He's meteorologist in charge for the National Weather Service offices for Houston and Galveston. Welcome to the Texas Standard, Jeffrey.
Good morning.
Tell us a little bit more about how much rainfall this region is receiving and how big of a rainfall map are we looking at here?
Well, you know, I guess the one good thing is it's been a relatively narrow band that set up really late yesterday afternoon and continued overnight, extended from parts of Galveston County up into southwestern Harris County, northern Fort Bend County. Some of those areas there, really from around Pearland up into south central Houston, already received between 10 and 12 inches of rain overnight. Wow. So we're seeing quite a bit of roads flooded there. As you mentioned, the 288-610 intersection is a lot of construction that's been closed due to high water. Fortunately, we haven't had water into homes yet, but that's one thing we'll have to be watching through the day as we still have more rain as beta meanders up the coast today.
Was this what was predicted of this tropical storm? Is the flooding not that much of a surprise? How do you read it?
Well, I mean, it's a little bit of both. Beta's been a somewhat unusual storm from the get-go, from even being named as a Greek system name all the way through. You know, we've been messaging 10 to 15, inches of rain on the high end. So that aspect, I think, hasn't caught any of the decision makers by surprise. I just think that, you know, we really couldn't see which specific area would get hit that hard. You know, some parts of the northern part of Houston's had less than an inch of rain. It's just that southern part of the metropolitan area that's taken the brunt of it so far.
I was sort of surprised by some of the remarks on social media, people looking out their windows at bayous and creeks below saying they'd never seen levels that high. And I thought, wow, what weren't parts being hit right now also inundated during Hurricane Harvey?
Right. You know, most of these areas got much, much worse during Harvey than they're seeing last night. But, you know, you have some new residents. It's a large metropolitan area. Harvey, believe it or not, it's been 3 years ago. So maybe some new folks moving in or folks that haven't really watched the bayous too carefully since Harvey. So, yes, I mean, since Harvey, a lot of these rises have been, you know, really high. Clear Creek, which runs along the Harris County, Galveston County border, that's out of its banks for most of the channel down towards the bay.
I know that there were some voluntary evacuations issued close to the coast, but it looks like for the most part, people are hunkering down for this storm. The aspect of this storm being life-threatening, it seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong, has to do with trying to get around on streets.
Right. And that's what we're urging people, especially people in the current flash flood warnings, to just stay put. Don't get yourself out there trying to move around on these roads. That's how we lose people. The vast majority of our fatalities with flood events are in vehicles. So if we can keep people off the roads, we're going to be fine. This will pass. Beta's going to move up the coast and push off tomorrow. So, you know, we'll start seeing improving conditions maybe 24 hours and beyond. At that point, we can get out and get back to our lives.
It's been an historically active hurricane season. This seems to be the first storm that's affected the Houston area significantly. And some have noted that it seems like we're getting more rainfall with these sorts of storms that move inland. Do you sense that that's actually happening, that we are seeing, at least within recent years, it's not just that we're getting rain and that they're more frequent, but we're getting a lot more of the rain?
Well, you know, that's a question that as a science, we're just going to have to keep putting our minds to. I mean, it's clear looking at the recent history. You know, we had Harvey 2017, obviously. Imelda was just last year. Yeah, that was another 40-inch rainfall. Now Beta, as the system's come in installed, and, you know, it's looking like it's going to give us a 15-inch type of rainfall. So, you know, there's certainly you can make an argument that something's going on. It's been a very, very active season, and we're not even into October yet. So, you know, the season is not over. So we urge people to pay attention. You know, we still have another month to go.
Jeffrey Evans is meteorologist in charge for the National Weather Service in Houston and Galveston. Jeffrey, thanks again.
Thank you.
By now, you've heard a lot about how COVID-19 has hurt the bottom line of retail, but perhaps you've heard less about how hard it's hit retail politics, the business of politicians directly interacting with their supporters or would-be supporters, and in the case of incumbents, constituents. Think selfie pics with voters, kissing babies, shaking hands at state fairs. It's all a firm no-no right now. Yet, as restrictions on other activities are being lifted, could the de facto restrictions on in-person campaigning be lifted anytime soon? Gromer Jeffers is a longtime political analyst with the Dallas Morning News. Gromer, welcome back.
Hey, David. It's great to be here with you.
Great to have you. So the question of the moment with just, 42 days left till the general election and so much on the line. Are candidates ready to risk a return to campaign rallies and such? Well, actually, I can think of one candidate who doesn't seem to be too terribly concerned.
Right, David, and the tone is being set by the president with many Republicans, but I'm finding that some Republicans and Democrats are now trying to get out there in this stretch run and meet voters in person, meet their constituents in person, and try to close the deal. And it's a fascinating question, David, because in politics, as you know, in-person contact is the best way to move votes, to sway a voter. And if you're not doing that, then you're at risk of not reaching voters, their hearts and minds, and therefore at risk of losing. So these candidates have some things to think about.
And it's especially important in close races, and we're seeing a lot of polls and a lot of analysis suggesting that these races are tightening. Many of these races are tightening. Now, what I know is that there is the potential for, in terms of health considerations, a kind of race to the bottom. Because if you look over the transom and you see your competitor who's doing a whole lot more glad-handing than you perhaps feel comfortable with or safe, what do you do? And you talk a little bit about what's been happening in District 24, I understand.
Yes, exactly. Now, and it's a tale of two candidates in a way, because Beth Mandine, the Republican, the former Irving mayor, she basically has never really stopped campaigning. I mean, she was handing out food at food banks and things when in March when we really, really got in this pandemic. But she's pretty much been meeting with folks and constituents. She says it's her duty as a candidate to get out there and meet voters where they are. In contrast, the Democrat in the race, Candace Valenzuela, the former Farmers Branch, Carrollton Farmers Branch School Board trustee, she is not doing any in-person campaigning. She lives in a multi-generation home. She has an older mother-in-law. She has children with various issues. So she does not want to risk bringing COVID-19 back to the home. And she doesn't want to risk her campaign volunteers getting sick either. So you have a situation where her campaign staff is probably what probably keeps them up at night is, are we doing the right thing mm-hmm. by not getting out there in person because our opponent is?
Well, that's really tough, especially if you consider, you know, what's been the proxy for that, and that's been Zoom and doing, you know, conference calls and yard signs, I suppose. It sounds like what you're saying is that there's no substitute, though, for that in-person. So maybe 2020 isn't rewriting the rules of politics as we've known it for some time.
It's adding to the rules of politics. And there are advantages with Zoom calls, right? Some advantages. Let's say you're at home playing around with the family or kids or pets or whatever. You can't make it out to the big rally.
Oh, right,
well, with
yeah,
a Zoom
yeah.
call, you don't have to. You can pop in and off, you
sure.
know, just with a click of a link. But remember in 18, Ted Cruz and Beto O'Rourke, their race were defined by the big rallies. Beto going to all 254 counties. In 2008, Obama became a star because of his big rallies with the speeches and the big soaring rhetoric mm-hmm. and everybody feeling good. I mean, the history of politics, David, as you know, meeting voters where they are, from the old whistle top stops tours, you know, getting off at the train station, talking to the crowd. Retail politics is where it's at.
Gromer Jeffers is a longtime political analyst with the Dallas Morning News. We'll link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Gromer, great to talk with you again, sir. Thank you.
Always great talking to you, David. Take care of yourself, okay?
You too. Wells Dunbar is monitoring social media on this Tuesday. Hello, Wells.
Hi, David. Well, we heard about the situation on the ground in Houston in the wake of Tropical Storm Beta.
Right.
Houston Public Media reporter Jen Rice has a particularly interesting comment on Twitter, noting that people are being encouraged to stay off the roads, but many eviction courts are still open. Southwest of Houston proper from Wharton County, Lawrence Strack describes the situation thusly on her Facebook page. He says, lots of much-needed rain, some gusty wind last night, and now misty and a little breezy. In his words, if you have to get a tropical storm, this is the one to get, at least in his neck of the woods. And when it rains, it pours, news-wise. News this morning that U.S. Senator Mitt Romney will support a vote for a Supreme Court nominee put forward by President Trump. Lots of folks sounding off on this one on social media, as you might expect. I'll be back with some of those reactions later in the program, David.
Of course, we would love to hear from you, Texas. So you know what to do. You look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar is looking for you, as always. He is our social media editor, and he will be back on the big broadcast in about 35 minutes or so with more of the comments from across the Lone Star State.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where faculty do research for the greater good. Like biology professor Dean Williams, who uses genetic mapping to help save horned lizards from extinction. More at tcu.edu/conservation.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The main attraction of the proposed bullet train between Dallas and Houston is speed. At over 200 miles an hour, the train would deliver passengers between the state's two biggest metro areas within 90 minutes. Progress on the project itself, though, has not been quite so quick. The company behind the rail line, Texas Central, has been bogged down by bureaucratic red tape and lawsuits from landowners who oppose the project. But yesterday, Texas Central announced it had cleared a major hurdle. The railway was approved by the U.S. Department of Transportation, clearing the way for construction to begin as soon as next year. Joining us now to tell us more, Juan Pablo Garnham, urban affairs reporter for the Texas Tribune. Juan Pablo, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
We've been tracking the progress of this project for quite some time. Just how big of a step is getting approval from the feds as you see it?
Well, it depends who you ask. According to the company, this is a huge step. This is what they've been waiting for. This clears two major issues. One is the environmental process. The other one is like the technical process. So for the first time, this Japanese technology for bullet trains is approved to work in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
But then if you talk to the detractors, they say that there are still instances to stop this project. And they also believe that there's no way that Texas Central can start the construction on the first half of 2021 because of technical issues. Still, the company says that first half of 2021 is the date that they could start building this project.
I'm kind of surprised when you say technical issues. Trains have been around for a long time. There's been several bullet trains around the world. Technical issues? I can understand if they're having trouble getting, say, property or they're in having legal battles. But what technical has to be worked out?
This is according to the opposers of the project. They say that some changes they have to do with the design of the rails and the trains, and that will take some time. But the narrative from the company is that things are on track and things should work out in the period that they say. After the construction starts, they expect that this should take 5 to 6 years to get done. So it all depends on who you are hearing about this project.
I see.
And there are questions about how the financial crisis will affect them from getting the money they need to invest in such a big project. It's $20 billion at the end. If the world markets are in crisis, it's going to be more difficult maybe to get that money. So there's a lot of moving parts that we'll need to work together to actually get this done. And then also something very important is that there's still one process, the Surface Transportation Board, which is another agency, another federal agency. They still have to sign in this project.
Ah, I see. So that has to happen before the project breaks ground, but you also still need to use eminent domain, I would assume, to obtain access to some of the land that it's going to need to go from Dallas to Houston. Where does that process currently stand?
Yeah, and that's been, of course, one of the big controversies. Any project this big will go into like fights, big and small, with landowners there. The company has already acquired 600 plots of land. They say that this is 40% of the plots that they need. They also have the areas for the stations in Dallas, Houston, and Brazos Valley. They say that so far they haven't needed to use eminent domain, but maybe now will be the time. And they already had this going to court. A Leon County resident previously argued that Texas Central is not an operating railroad, so they couldn't do this process. They couldn't do eminent domain. So far, courts have been given the reason to the company, but the resident is saying that he was taking the case to the Texas Supreme Court. So one thing that is important is that yesterday ruling, the news yesterday, they don't yet allow to use eminent domain. So the company still has to wait for this last approval from the Surface Transportation Board.
Juan Pablo Garnham is an urban affairs reporter for the Texas Tribune. We'll link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Juan Pablo, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. It was 1968 when Texan Lyndon Johnson, then president, signed into law the nation's first official Hispanic Heritage Week. Another Texan and president, George H.W. Bush, would expand that commemoration to a full month, and so it has been since, each mid-September through mid-October. Here in Texas, the impact of Hispanic culture and history knows no season, and one Houston woman has spent much of her life trying to draw recognition to that point, as Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval reports.
Nearly 40 years ago, Dorothy Caram started the tradition of the Día de la Hispanidad as president of the Institute of Hispanic Culture. That very first year, she brought in the famous Mexican film actor Cantinflas to Miller Outdoor Theater.
El verbo conjugar se conjuga en esta forma.
Here's a famous scene of Cantinflas teaching Spanish.
Vosotros conjugo, ellos conjugo, tú conjugo y yo conjugo.
That I never did want to shut up. I wanted to say what I wanted to say.
Caram is now 87 years old and has led a life of firsts like this. She was often the first and only woman and Latina on dozens of committees she served. She gives me a tour of her home. It feels like a museum of Houston's Latino history. Even though it's summer, she has a Christmas nativity on full display. It was crafted by her mother, who was from Mexico and taught ceramics.
She made this in the early 1950s while I was in high school. And my father made the papier-mâché table for her to put it on.
She says her dad used to help actor Clark Gable with productions at the Palace Theater.
In one of the productions of that Palace Theater, they needed someone to dance the Jarabe Tapatio. And he met Mother then, and they danced in the production. And that, so I'm the results of a Jarabe Tapatio.
Garam got her bachelor and master from Rice University, and in the late 50s, she married her husband, Dr. Pedro Garam, a Mexican-Lebanese neurosurgeon. Together, they helped launch some of the first organizations in Houston that centered Latino culture and education. Through one group, the Houston Hispanic Forum, Garam organized the first Career and Education Day for Latino students and families, a tradition still alive today.
This is a new concept. It didn't exist in any other group, and I remember going to HISD to ask them to bus the kids in. And they said, oh, you're a bunch of Hispanics. You're never going to do anything. That was the answer I got. Made me more determined. And everybody in our group was more determined. And we had about 2,000 students and their parents the first year.
Garam taught Spanish in HISD for 5 years and helped create some of the first magnet schools in the country to help desegregate the district. She remembers school strikes or huelgas because Houston schools were only busing Latino students into Black schools.
Well, instead of taking the white kids, they took the Hispanic kids only and bused them. So that's what brought on the huelga schools. It was an interesting period, and that's when the concept of, well, let's make this school an academy that only teaches arts.
Garam has received high honors from the Mexican and Spanish governments, and awards decorate her office. But she's still fighting for one goal, a museum in Houston dedicated to Latino arts and culture.
I just want the best for our community, and I want, like, to celebrate its culture and history and stuff like my parents did. So hopefully God will let me live long enough to see the museum. That's what I want to see.
In Houston, I'm Elizabeth Troval for the Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Fort Worth is officially designating the second week of October as Indigenous Peoples Week. Leroy Strongcloud with the Lipan Apache Tribe of Texas helped push for the proclamation presented at the City Council meeting this morning. He says support is growing to replace Columbus Day with a holiday honoring Native American histories and cultures.
Every year there seems to be more cities and states, municipalities, you know, getting on board. My group is actually working on submitting a bill for the state of Texas to recognize the second Monday in October as Indigenous Peoples Day.
More than 100 other local governments in the U.S., including Austin, Corpus Christi, and Dallas, have made similar designations. Early next month, Tarrant County is also expected to designate the second Monday in October as Indigenous Peoples Day. Officials in the Rio Grande Valley are urging people to respond to the 2020 census before the population count ends later this month. Starr County Judge Eloy Vera says about 47% of residents have responded by phone, mail, or online. He adds some communities within the county have even lower self-response rates.
In the La Grulla area, we're at 34.6. That's one of the lowest percentages that we have in the county.
The census helps determine how state and federal money is distributed for a range of services, including education and housing. Judge Vera says an undercount of even 1,000 residents could cost Starr County $30 million in funding over the next 10 years. The last day to respond to the census is September 30th. The Houston Rockets are pushing back their National Voter Registration Day event at the Toyota Center due to Tropical Storm Beta. The voter registration drive, which was originally scheduled for today, will now take place Friday. The San Antonio Spurs held a drive-through event last week to help people register to vote for the upcoming election by the October 5th deadline. The U.S. House has approved setting up a memorial in Washington, D.C., dedicated to diplomats from the Republic of Texas who negotiated ties with the U.S. nearly two centuries ago. Central Texas Congressman Lloyd Doggett authored the legislation and spoke on the House floor before Monday's vote.
Today, we find the plaques about the work of the Texas legation in London and Paris, but not yet here in Washington, where the legation's effort had its most profound effect.
The bipartisan bill authorizes the National Park Service to work with the Daughters of the Republic of Texas to design and find a location for the marker in the U.S. Capitol. The measure now heads to the Senate. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Texas Secretary of State, providing voters details on which approved forms of photo ID they can take to the polls. More at votetexas.gov. or 800-252-VOTE.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The economic toll of COVID-19 has led many more Texans to seek assistance from food banks. An organization called Feeding Texas coordinates with some 21 food banks across the Lone Star State. It says more than 25% of Texas families are facing food insecurity right now. That's twice as many as before the pandemic. The economic toll is also hitting the state of Texas, and state agencies have been asked to find ways to cut their budgets. But Feeding Texas says that the reductions proposed by the Texas Department of Agriculture also hurts food banks. In a letter to the governor, it claims the cut translates to more than 15 million pounds of produce that food banks couldn't buy. Celia Cole is the CEO of Feeding Texas. Celia, welcome to the Texas Standard, and thanks for your time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Let's talk about this proposal to cut the Texas Department of Agriculture surplus agricultural grant. Explain what that grant actually does.
Sure. Well, this is a grant that we've had for 20 years now, actually. This year is the 20th anniversary with funds from the legislature that flow through the Texas Department of Agriculture to food banks to help them source produce for distribution to the families that we serve. 100% of the funds go directly to the farmer to help offset their costs of donating surplus produce to the food bank or to the freight provider that moves that produce from field to fork.
What number are we talking about here? How much is involved with this surplus agricultural grant?
Sure.
And what would these cuts do to that figure?
Well, it's funded right now at about $4.5 million per year. And what TDA is proposing amounts to a 44% cut or a loss of almost $2 million. And this will really cut into our ability to meet the needs of families, particularly during this pandemic.
Let's back up for just a moment, because it strikes me this grant would help both farmers and food banks, right? I mean, this is, in a sense, the sort of win-win that one would think you wouldn't want to cut. So what's behind the proposal?
We were shocked. I was shocked to get the phone call a couple of weeks ago asking me to sign an amendment to our contract reducing funding by almost $2 million. My understanding from the Department of Ag is that this was the only place they could find a cut in their budget. But we've reached out to the legislature to impress on them the short-sightedness of these cuts, particularly at a time where food banks are serving twice as many families as we were a year ago.
And tell us how this becomes a loss for farmers right now.
So the specialty crop industry in Texas has been one of the hardest hit by COVID. A lot of the farmers that we work with really rely on food banks as an outlet for the product that they can't sell, either because there's no market for it or it's slightly imperfect but perfectly edible. And we've had many of them reach out to us already, even before we let them know about this potential cut, to let us know they're struggling and they're not even sure if they're going to be able to come back after the pandemic. So taking this extra source of support from them this right time really hits farmers hard.
So the farmers would take a hit, the food banks would take a hit, and those who rely on food banks would take a hit. You've sent the letter to the governor. What else are you doing, and do you think there's a way for this cut to be shifted elsewhere?
I'm hoping so. We're meeting with all the offices of the legislative leadership. We've reached out to all our ag partners as well, like the Texas Farm Bureau and the Texas Ag Council. We're urging them to weigh in. And so we are hopeful that this cut will be taken off the table before the legislature even convenes in January.
Let me ask you, though, a lot of agencies, a lot of public services face likely cuts, and everyone across the board has been told to brace for impact. Why should this program be preserved and not some other? Because it's going to have to be cut from somewhere. What would you cut?
Well, first, I'd say I think the cuts were intended to really impact agencies' administrative budgets. I don't think they were intended to cut or gut grant programs like this one. So we would say, first, look for places where less harm is caused. But second, you know, with everything, all the other struggles that low-income Texans are going to be facing to get back on their feet after this terrible pandemic, making sure that they can afford food allows them to do all of those other things. It allows them to look for work. It allows them to care for their children. It allows them to stay healthy. You take that away and you lose so much more. So really, I think food and food assistance for needy families is one of the most important ways we can support Texas and Texans to get back on their feet.
Let me ask you, back in, I guess it was April, May, we were seeing photographs outside of some of the larger food distribution centers in San Antonio, in Dallas, cars lined up for what seemed like miles, snaking around parking lots and such, people trying to get food relief. What's the picture now?
Well, unfortunately, we're still seeing a pretty high level of demand. We distributed about the same amount of food in August as we did in July and May. So we've not yet seen a significant drop off, although we're hoping to see a decrease as the unemployment numbers obviously go down. But at the end of the day, we're going to be facing a much higher level of need for at least a year, even when the economy gets going again. It takes a lot longer for people who started off with nothing to get back on their feet after a hit like this.
Celia Cole is the CEO for Feeding Texas. Celia, thanks again.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. It was the day the music paused. A little over 7 months ago, March 6th, Austin Mayor Steve Adler canceled the International Festival South by Southwest. It was a preemptive move as the coronavirus started to spread across the nation, shocking many and starting a chain reaction among events big and small across the U.S. But what happens when the music stops in the live music capital of the world? It's the subject of a new podcast from our sister stations, KUT and KUTX, that launches today. It's called Pause Play, and it's hosted by KUT on-air host and producer Miles Bloxon and KUTX producer Elizabeth McQueen. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So Elizabeth, in a nutshell, what's this podcast and why did you want to make it?
It is the brainchild of our executive producer, Matt Riley. He's also the program director over at KUTX. He had this idea to do a podcast that explored the impact that COVID-19 had had on the live music ecosystem in Austin. And I thought that was a great idea. I played music for a long time. And it's been, you know, COVID-19 has really devastated kind of every aspect of live music in Austin. But there will come a day when we come out of it. So we wanted to explore the impact that it's had, but also, you know, what survival strategies people are using, what adaptations they're making. And, you know, hopefully we'll be able to chart coming out of this pandemic.
Before we turn to Miles, I want you to talk a little bit more about the impact of the cancellation of South by Southwest, in particular on musicians. I was in Los Angeles recently, and someone said their world just started tumbling down after that event was canceled. And, you know, a lot of people think of South by Southwest as a kind of Austin event, especially if you live in Texas. But in Texas, and for that matter, nationally and internationally, this was a genuine earthquake.
It was. I mean, South by Southwest brings about 400,000 people to Austin. The amount of money it brings is around like $339 million into Austin. And so many people depend on the money that South by Southwest brings in. But a lot of artists also depend on South by Southwest. If you're releasing a new record, this is where you will let people know about it. And it's also this like behemoth of a festival that I don't think anyone really thought could get canceled. So not only did the closure of South by Southwest really financially devastate a lot of people, but it also signaled to like Austin and to the rest of the country that COVID-19 was serious. I mean, because if something is serious enough to cancel South by Southwest, then it's a huge deal.
Miles, I was thinking about the fact that this melds in so many ways news and music, and the fact that there's a saying that, you know, one door closes, another door opens. And it seems to me that that's part of the story here. It's not just the devastation aspect of this, but it's, in a sense, the opportunities that this has left, the creative opportunities for some of these musicians, right?
Absolutely. A lot of musicians are turning to other ways to make money and to make up, you know, that financial loss. They're streaming. They're doing a lot of stuff on Instagram. They're doing live concerts now, things that they never thought that they would kind of dive into because they can't do that in-person performance that they're so accustomed to. We even had a lot of musicians tell us that they're selling more merchandise, or they are, you know, setting up concerts as much as possible as they can online from their living room to, you know, their followers. So there's a lot of different things that they're looking into, and it's also inspiring a lot of new music as well. They're using this opportunity to kind of expand and tell people that, hey, you know what, we can be positive, we can get through this. Here's a song. I hope it helps you get through this process like it's helping me get through this process.
What was it that Elvis Costello once quoted? He said something like, talking about music is like dancing about architecture. So we can't just talk about the music. Let's listen to a little bit of this new music that's being incubated during this extraordinary time.
Days like this, I'm trying to stay out my mind. I can't overthink it with my vibe. So my focus stays on paper chasing, double up on my paper daily. I can't lack, I hate wasting my time. Know my focus on, you know my focus on paper.
So, Elizabeth, tell us a little bit about the music we're hearing. Who is the artist and what's the backstory?
So, this song is called Focus. It's by an Austin artist called Jay Solja. It features Jake Lloyd and Kat Carter, who are two other Austin artists. And it's from an album that he created during quarantine. He talks about that a little bit in the first episode of Pause Play.
The quarantine actually helped me get innovative and focus on an album, since I couldn't throw my shows. I was like, yo, I got to do something to generate some kind of, source of income, you know. So I put together an album called From the Soul.
You know, one criticism of the response to COVID-19 is how this pandemic has sort of managed to exacerbate a societal problem that's already disenfranchised a lot of folks. And that's something you go into when you talk about the affordability of the music industry in Austin, something that you have intimate experience with, Elizabeth. What were you hearing from your fellow musicians?
Well, you know, even before COVID hit, there was a bit of a crisis going on in Austin around affordability, both for musicians and venues, and really for, you know, anyone who lives in Austin. Rents have increased, property values have increased, and it really makes it hard to live here. When I moved here 20 years ago, I worked part-time, I played gigs at night, and I lived a fine life. And I know that artists and musicians moving here and living here now, that's not the case. They really have to, you have to make a lot more money to live in Austin. And so it was hard already before COVID hit. And now that we have this global pandemic where the main source of income for, you know, our venues and our musicians has been taken away, I mean, people are really struggling to figure out how to survive in such an expensive city.
Miles, I would imagine that if you're a musician, you're going to feel somewhat cathartic listening to this podcast. Who did you, though, have in mind as the potential listener? I mean, are you just thinking primarily about Austin, or are you thinking beyond?
We're thinking beyond. We're thinking everybody. I feel like every single city has somewhat of a music ecosystem there. I think this touches everyone because musicians are the ones that keep us happy. Music brings us all together. And so if our creatives are not in a great space and they can't create, I mean, that affects everybody.
So Miles, what's your sense, just as you've been putting together this first podcast, that there is more optimism about the music industry as we work our way toward an eventual end, one hopes, to this pandemic? Or do you think that there's more pessimism given all that these people have been through?
There's a little bit of both, but I feel like we keep running into people that are more hopeful and they are into the creative process and they're just taking it moment by moment. They're staying in the present moment and they're developing music that inspires everybody to get through this moment that we're all in together.
We've been talking with Miles Bloxon, on-air host and producer for KUT and KUTX, and Elizabeth McQueen, producer of KUTX's hip-hop show, The Breaks. Together, they co-host a new podcast out today called Pause Play on COVID-19's effects on the music industry in the live music capital of the world, as it calls itself, Austin, Texas. The podcast is available wherever fine podcasts are served. Of course, we'll have a link over at texasstandard.org, and we're told it's also available on social media platforms, too. Thanks to you both for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, sharing that regular screenings like mammograms and colonoscopies are essential preventative appointments. Early detection of cancer often leads to better outcomes. More at texasoncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Heading into the November elections, all eyes are on the Latino vote in Texas. Rising power among that voting group is playing out as a pandemic continues to disproportionately affect its communities. Now, experts say that means Latino voters may be more distracted than usual, but also have more at stake. KUT Austin's Ashley Lopez reports this dynamic has also made it difficult to predict just what kind of impact this voting bloc will have on this year's election.
As early voting in Texas draws near, Latino voters have a lot on their minds as they consider their options. Victoria DeFrancesco Soto is the assistant dean for civic engagement for the LBJ School of Public Affairs at UT Austin. She says COVID-19 in particular is a huge weight on most of them.
We are the community that is hardest hit in terms of infection rate, in terms of death toll, in terms of economic hit. Latinas have the highest unemployment rate. So Latinos have a whole bunch going on right now.
DeFrancesco Soto says it's been pulling attention away from the election in the past several months. And usually the summer months, she says, are a time when campaigns, particularly Democrats, needed to introduce their nominee to voters.
But in a pandemic world, the Democrats aren't doing that on-the-ground mobilization.
Republicans, of course, have an incumbent president. Donald Trump has had 4 years to engage these voters. And this is just one reason experts say polling shows Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden's support among Latinos is weaker than that of Hillary Clinton in 2016, at least so far. And while a lot has been made of these national polls, Latino experts in Texas say they think the concern is overblown. Emmy Ruiz, a Democratic strategist in Texas, says she never puts that much stock in polling of Latino voters anyway.
Latinos are notoriously underpolled, right, and underrepresented in polls. And so I really would not read that much into it.
This has been a perennial problem that hasn't improved much. Juan Carlos Huerta, a political science professor at Texas A&M University in Corpus Christi, says there's what's called a sampling problem in most national polls of Latinos.
It seems like every year we go through the same routine where these samples are done, national samples are done, with maybe 800 voters, or maybe they've been done in one state with maybe 500 or 400 voters. And then we start trying to extrapolate what that means for subgroups.
And Huerta says that's just not helpful. Plus, he says he has a big problem with looking at Latino voters nationwide as one group.
That aggregates so much because we know there are national origin differences. There's state by state differences, and so it can be real tricky to try to do that.
But if you look specifically at Texas and its Latino population, it's not surprising to see some support for Republicans. Former Governor George Bush received a majority of the Latino vote when running for office in the 90s. And current Governor Greg Abbott has also received strong Latino support in his two elections. The LBJ School's Victoria DeFrancesco Soto says Republicans have also been reaching out to conservative Latinos as of late, which could actually move the needle in a place like Texas.
We see this base of Latino conservatism that has been here for a long time. And so Trump, in spending, you know, quite a bit of time over the last couple of years in Texas, has been cultivating that vote. has been reaching out to them.
And while Biden's campaign and Democrats are starting to spend more money on targeting groups like Latino voters, most of the organizing has been happening for years. Julieta Garibay was an activist for 15 years in Texas and now works in philanthropy supporting community groups. She says late in the game outreach from Democrats just won't be as effective as those existing relationships with voters.
People are connected to their local organizations that have been doing grassroots organizing, that have been organizing with them, that know them by name, right? So a lot of these organizations have kind of like the headway of being able to engage with voters.
And some of these voter mobilization groups in Texas say they do see general enthusiasm among Latinos. Ivan Gutierrez with Supermajority says many Latinos understand the stakes of this election and plan to vote.
What we've also heard is that people do understand, Latinas in particular, that this is the most important election of their lifetime.
Gutierrez says polls that show Latinos are not as enthusiastic about voting for the Democratic presidential candidate don't show the overall enthusiasm among these voters ahead of the election.
You know, when you're asking people about whether or not there's a specific amount of enthusiasm over do you know that you need to vote are two different questions. And I think that, you know, when they go to the polls, I think they will vote for Joe Biden.
Recent polling has shown Biden maintains an edge among Latino voters in the state. But there are still a lot of undecideds. The campaign has recently been running ads targeting Latino voters in Texas. It's hard to tell so far whether those ads are making a difference. I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
Reporters from our partner stations across the Lone Star State are working on stories about unlocking the Latino vote ahead of the November election. You can find more election coverage and ask questions about the process at texasdecides.org. And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is monitoring the talk of Texas on this, for what many Texans is a very rainy Tuesday. Right. Hello there, Wells.
Hi, David. Good to be with you today. Definitely a rainy and overcast one there in many parts of Texas. Amen. Seemingly matching the mood of many folks there on the left of the spectrum regarding this news about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and what appears to be momentum in the United States Senate to get a hearing or a vote, rather, for President Trump's nominee. Lots of people talking about this after Mitt Romney came out in support of a vote in the Senate for a new nominee to the Supreme Court. Here are some of the reactions we're hearing via Twitter. Chris Hendricks says, I think Republicans putting someone on the bench before a new president is inaugurated is a mistake. He says if the Dems win, they should pack the courts and make D.C. and Puerto Rico states to add more Democratic senators. The gloves will be off. So lots of discussion about what would happen, whether or not, honestly, if Democrats have the stomach for this sort of for these sorts of efforts, should the president get to name a third pick to the Supreme Court here in his first term.
That's right. That would make it a 6-3 conservative majority. Yeah. I was just reading in the New York Times, they are reporting Romney backs moving forward on court pick, as you were just saying. And they go on, the headline goes on to say Trump has votes lined up. The move by Senator Mitt Romney, the Times says, all but assures that President Trump will have the votes to cement a conservative majority on the high court. So the Times appears to be conceding that it's unstoppable at this juncture, although we have heard from some prominent Democrats, as I know you're aware, Wells, that there are some tricks up folks' sleeves that they are not willing to disclose. So it'll be interesting to see what happens yet. I believe I heard, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but I believe I heard that the president is set to announce his selection this weekend.
This weekend, so, yes, that's what we're hearing. I believe so. Yeah. So definitely watch this space. You know, we're hearing from tons of folks about that train talk, about the potential for that high-speed rail line from Houston to Dallas, 250 miles in 90 minutes. Lots of folks pretty excited about this. Lots of folks asking, when's my rail line coming? Anna Lee asks for the I-35 corridor to come next. Jerry Clayton asks if we can do San Antonio next. And this interesting tweet from Fred Cantu, veteran Austin newsman. He tweets that the whole situation has given him a sense of deja vu, like Texas TGV in the 1990s, a different company with their plan to go between Dallas and Houston and expand to Austin and San Antonio. Well, everything old is new again.
I guess that's what they say, yeah. There has been some talk about a possible spur out to San Antonio eventually, if that train ever actually takes off.
Maybe I'm mixing metaphors there. Hey, we're out of time for the big broadcast, but the news continues at texasstandard.org. And of course, right back here on the radio tomorrow. We hope you'll join us then. On behalf of the entire Texas Standard team, I'm David Brown, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.